Greetings, and welcome to Research on Religion, a weekly podcast series devoted to the social scientific study of religion. I'm Anthony Gill, your host, professor of political science at the University of Washington, and distinguished senior fellow at Baylor University's Institute for Studies of Religion, the gracious sponsor of our podcast. We encourage you to visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org to post comments, ask questions, access additional material related to today's program, and to find out what is happening at the Institute. All right, let's begin.
Rejoice, Catholics! You have a new pope. And all the rest of us? Well, we are wondering what all the hubbub is about. If you remember last week, we featured Jeremy Lant discussing how the mass media reported on the rare resignation of a pontiff and the selection of a new one. We noted that the depth of understanding amongst reporters and pundits, including those of the Catholic faith, is pretty shallow at best. Most of our media is geared toward quick sound bites that are repeated by talking heads who have little time to invest in studying what they are reporting on in sufficient depth. As such, questions still remain for many of us, and what better way to get a good grasp on what goes on during these papal transitions than to go to my trusted source for all things Catholic, James Felak, professor of history at the University of Washington and one of my favorite guests on this show. He has appeared three times before talking about the papacies of John Paul II and Pius XII, the so-called wartime pontiff, and also what went on at Vatican Council II, all of which can be found in our extensive archives, now approaching 150 episodes. To make that search easier, we will just link to these earlier podcasts on the webpage devoted to this particular interview. James is also the author of After Hitler, Before Stalin: Catholics, Communists, and Democrats in Slovakia, 1945 to 1948, and is currently researching Pope John Paul II's journeys throughout Poland during his pontifical reign, a book that I am anxiously anticipating. James, once again, welcome back to Research on Religion.
Oh, glad to be here, Tony.
Hey, first off, I want to mention that we are talking on March 18th, 2013, in the event that anything we talk about today sounds a bit dated, even after just a week or two. I know historians are very sensitive to that subject. And I also want to thank you for coming out on relatively short notice, as I know that you are scurrying around here at the university because we are in the midst of exam week and spring break coming up, and you have a lot of researching and conferencing that you're getting involved in.
Had the Pope given more advance notice of his resignation, I would have had, you know, more time to...
Yeah, this is one of these things.
This is a new situation.
Yeah, this is one of these things with the podcast. We tend to do slow news and analyze things and that, but there was a high demand for this and a high demand for you as well to tell us what we need to know here. So let's get right down to it. Our previous discussions that we had on our previous podcast, they all center around either particular popes or, in the case of Vatican Council II, a specific historical event. Now, we did put all those discussions into a broader context regarding Catholicism and the Church, but today I want to start out with very broad and with some basic questions about the papacy in order to get a more proper understanding of the recent papal transition that we saw in Rome. And this is also prompted by watching some, but not all, of the coverage of the Conclave of the Cardinals. And as I sat there and watched this, I thought to myself, oy vey, none of these folks know what they're talking about. So let's get down to fundamentals. First off, what does the Pope do in the hierarchy of the Catholic Church?
Well, Pope has a number of functions. So, for example, he's the court of final instance. You know, so if there's some problem in the Church, they're generally dealt with locally, and then they start to work their way up the ladder, and the Pope will be the last word. He's also the guy who has to, he calls a church council, and he has to ratify what that council decides. He kind of has an absolute veto over conciliar teachings.
Now, do popes always call a council, or is it just at their discretion?
Well, for the last 1,000 years or so, all councils were called by popes, but most popes won't call councils. They're just called as you said, at his discretion. Another thing the Pope does is teach. At various levels, and probably most popularly through what are called encyclicals. These are letters he writes. They come, you know, sometimes once a year, once every other year. Some popes do them more frequently, some more rarely. But these are elaborations on particular teachings addressed to Catholics and really oftentimes to the whole world. Another thing the Pope does is he represents a symbol of the unity of Christianity. Catholics believe that ultimately the Church is one, And one person symbolizes that. So to be in the Catholic Church, you are in communion with the Pope. He's sort of the guy that holds it all together.
Yeah, a representative mm-hmm. of the entire church. Hey, let me ask you about that court of final instance. Is that much like our Supreme Court here in the United States? And how often is that utilized? Is it dealing with these cases on a day-to-day basis, or do they come up rarely, maybe once every couple of years or so?
Well, it all depends on, you know, how big the case is. A lot of it just gets handled in Vatican bureaucracy. So they'll make a decision, or there'll be, you know, fights over how does one translate the liturgy into particular language, and how do you render particular words, and the Vatican will have a say in that and can ultimately make the decision and override, you know, local church on things like that. So you'll get those sorts of things. So it all depends, but it's not a... it's not like the Pope's, you know, a full-time Supreme Court justice. It's just that ultimately it's his responsibility when a final decision has to be made. And so these, you know, and also, you know, popes will make what are Catholics regard as infallible pronouncements.
That's what I wanted to ask. Is this where papal infallibility is invoked?
No, that's invoked very, very, very rarely.
Okay.
Maybe once or twice in the last, 150 years.
Okay.
So it has to be some... either a really big issue or something. It has to be about either faith or morals, and the Pope has to make it clear that he's speaking as the head of the church on this particular type of issue. So 99% of what the Pope says wouldn't be regarded as infallible, but it's regarded as serious, something Catholics need to take into account and either accept or at least, you know, wrestle with as part of their faith.
Mm-hmm. Now, one of the things that you just mentioned is that it's not like the Pope is the Supreme Court justices here in the United States, but one of the things that I noticed in the coverage of the papal transition was that the media seemed to view the Pope as a president. It was viewed through the lens of American politics. And we talked with this a bit last week with Jeremy Lott. But what are your impressions of this? Is the Pope a president? Is it akin to the president here in the United States, or is it something a little bit different?
Yeah, it's the president or the CEO model you'll get sometimes for the Pope
right, in
the media. But no, he's different. First of all, he's different in the sense that when you get a new president just cleans house. I mean, you get a whole new cabinet, everything's changed. It's one party replacing another. Whereas with the papacy, there's really a sense for a continuity. Like, it's not like one party has beaten the other. You know, behind closed doors, there are definitely factions pushing this way and that way, and they've got to come to some sort of an agreement. But first of all, remember, you need a two-thirds vote to win. So, you know, imagine if the United States, to get a president, we needed a two-thirds vote. So that would, you know, that would push everybody toward the center.
Right,
would be one thing. So that's happening with papacy, and then also when the Pope will sometimes, you know, he'll appoint new people. And we can watch now and see who the Pope puts in charge of the Vatican offices. But there's also going to be kind of a continuity too. Like, you'll leave some people on from the old regime. You know, Obama's not leaving, you know, a lot of George Bush's cabinet on, but in the papacy that wouldn't be all that unusual. The sense is really on continuity, that these aren't radical. Even if you get a new pope with a new spirit, with a new agenda, it's still never sort of framed so much that way. It's always, you know, we're developing organically within the Catholic tradition. We may need to adapt to new situations, but this isn't some, like, it's not like a big swing of the pendulum like you get in American or British politics.
Yeah, that's one of the things I want to know, and I think people are interested in. We see this in the news, is, oh, the church is going to take a new direction. I'm wondering if the church is a nimble type of ship, like a sloop out there on a windy lake, or if it's a large aircraft carrier that takes a lot of time to maneuver in one direction or another. So it seems that if it's not as nimble to move as one might think.
No, it's more like the aircraft carrier, or you know, elephant is a good metaphor. I have a friend who grew up in India, in Kerala, which is a part of India that has a lot of Catholics. It was Christian since ancient times, and they actually had, you know, elephants that would go on rampages and chase you where he was living, or at least kids were warned about that possibility, and you were taught when an elephant chases you to always zigzag, because because they're going to run faster than you, but if they're zigzag, they cannot make those turns. And Catholic Church, you know, it can't zigzag very easily, and it just kind of moves slowly. It can't make rapid turns the way secular issues. And that's why you don't get popes commenting really on current events that much. You
know, yeah, and that's one of the interesting things that we noticed last week with Jeremy Lott, is that much of the coverage really focused on very temporal issues. That, you know, is the Pope going to take a position on this or that or the other thing? And I kept thinking, you know, the church has been around for 2,000 some years. And when these commentators say, well, they're not addressing the issues of the day, they need to get into the 21st century, I just scratch my head and say, you know, they've lasted a long time. And I'm pretty sure that they're going to be around for a lot longer. So,
well, here's another dimension. Is it's a global church. It's got 1.2 billion members now is the official count. And it's... So you might address an issue that, say, you know, people care about in the Netherlands, but it might not play at all in Madagascar or vice versa. And so popes always have to kind of be careful not to sound like they're only addressing the interests of one particular, you know, because American Catholics and just American citizens have a totally different set of interests than, say, people in Central Africa.
Mm-hmm.
But and so Pope really has to make sure he's not alienating one or the other. And so that's where the role of bishops come in. I mean, it's really the bishop's job to make the church kind of fit the particular context it's operating in, to deal with the kind of issues that come up in that country. Whereas at the papal level, it's too hard to do that because, you know, even when the Pope writes an encyclical, it's understood this is for everybody. So Pope's talking about, you know, gender relations in the family. That's going to sound different in America than it's going to sound like in the Philippines or, you know, Latin America versus North America.
Yeah.
So those are – so again, that's the job of the bishops, is to really make those things fit the local context.
And how does this work too? Because I know that different countries have these national bishops' conferences that convene on a somewhat regular basis, maybe once a year or every several months or so. How does the Pope interact with those national conferences of bishops?
Well, this is a huge question. This is one of the key questions, and I think it's going to be on the table now with the new Pope. So going back to the early church, you know, bishops came together. That was the bishops of the region. When there was some decision need to be made, you know, the bishops in France, Spain, North Africa, wherever, would come together, and the bishop of the largest city was called the Metropolitan, and he would run the meeting. And they would deal with regional issues. And you'd only have a council that really was binding on the whole church when some big issue came up. And those would happen just maybe once a century or so, if that. So a lot of the church was run by local councils. And then in modern times, this kind of made a comeback again. But the issue is always, how does the Pope relate to the national bishops, either as conferences or just the individual bishops? Because there's the one model is that he's kind of like the CEO, and these guys are like running the branches of the corporation.
Yeah, different subsidiaries. You have the Catholic branch of America or something,
sure.
Right? Yeah.
And then the other view is that they're all really, in a certain sense, equals. That they're all bishops. You know, Pope is Bishop of Rome, technically. And the key terminology here is in the early church, the Bishop of Rome would refer to the other bishops as his brothers. And then around the, I want to say, 5th, 6th century, he starts calling them his sons. So it's kind of like, I'm your father, you are the sons. Mm-hmm. And if you notice that Pope Francis referred to them as his brothers, as one of the first things he said when he was elected.
Wow, he's going old school.
It seems like he's going back to that. And it came up at Vatican I, which was the first Vatican Council in 1869, 1870, when they proclaimed the papal infallibility. And the council, then of course that raises the question, well, how do bishops relate to the Pope in that situation? And they never got to finish the council because of the Franco-Prussian War.
Yeah.
So Vatican II brought that issue back. Mm-hmm. And even there, it kind of got addressed theoretically, but the implementation was never fully carried out. So there's a lot of tension within the church between people that want more autonomy for bishops and people that want a stronger papacy. And generally, the more conservative you are, the more stronger papacy you want. And the more liberal Catholics would want more autonomy. But that's not always the case. It was really just the case when if you think the Pope's more conservative than your bishop, then you like the Pope. Otherwise, it goes the other way around. So what happens, and we can see that Bergoglio has done a number of things to show that he just wants to be like more or less either first among equals or a peer, really, of the other bishops. He rides in the minivan with the bishops. He just sits at whatever's the empty seat at the dinner with the other bishops or with the cardinals. And so he's pushing, it seems, in that direction. And there was an interesting thing on the news from the Telegraph paper in Britain. And it was about how back in, if you remember, when Benedict made the statement in Regensburg a few years ago that offended Muslims. And Bergoglio and another bishop spoke out against that, and they said that this was an unfortunate statement, and I disassociate myself with it. And the Vatican cracked down on them and told them basically not to say anything on this issue again. And that gives me a true report. I just saw it in one place. But if that turned out to have been correct, then that's more evidence that the new pope may be someone who doesn't like this heavy-handed Vatican telling bishops what they can and cannot say. And so he may. So one of the big changes we may see in his pontificate is kind of easing up on the bishops, letting the local bishops have more leeway in how they want to talk about things. But that's all speculation. But I'm getting the sense that the spirit he's trying to cultivate is one of collegiality, is the word the Catholics will use. Yeah. Collegiality among bishops rather than the sort of the monarchical pontificate.
Yeah, we're only about 4 or 5 days into his reign right now, and things could change. I think one of the things I was watching on the news is when he started walking into crowds, you could see his hand and the guard going, what are you doing? You don't do this. Get back here. You know, that's a neat thing to do initially. We'll see if...
And this is what Pope John XXIII did. And he had the same problem with his handlers. He walked down the street to a prison, to a hospital, and whatnot. And so, yeah, it'll be interesting.
Well, that brings up an issue of how much a new pope can have an imprint upon the papacy, and it relates to another thing we were talking about before, the momentum of the church, as we likened it to an aircraft carrier or an elephant, the things that are very, very difficult to turn. And you had also mentioned that the bureaucracy of the church is pretty continuous. It's not that he comes in and has a new cabinet and sweeps everybody aside. Does the Pope, though, have any say on the bureaucracy? Does he get to appoint some new folks who are in the defense of the doctrine of the faith or other committees? Are there committees that help to run the church, and does he have any say over
that? Oh, yeah, no, there's a whole bureaucracy, just like a U.S. president has with the departments of state and various ministries and sub-ministries and departments to handle relations with other religions and departments for the media and on and on and on. So he's got all that, and he could conceivably fire all those guys and bring in a whole new bunch. This is the point, is that the church tends to not act so radically. First of all, it's a kind of refutation of your predecessor, in a sense, in a blatant way. And so there's always this sense you don't want to move so radically. But, you know, he was chosen, as far as we can tell, partly to clean things up, to really shake up the bureaucracy and really work against some of those entrenched interests. So expect that he's going to move in that direction. And really what he just needs to do is to have, you know, like a really strong chief of staff and, you know, secretary of state that can go in and do that kind of work for him, and he can spend his time traveling and shaking hands. I mean, that'd be ideal.
Now, would he be pulling this quote-unquote chief of staff, or whatever they might call it, from the College of Cardinals? Or
generally, they're cardinals that get those.
Okay.
And if you're not, you can be made one pretty quickly.
Okay, so that's possible. And that's something I'm going to get to a little bit when we talk about the conclave of cardinals. But let's go ahead and move, since we're talking a great deal about Francis I now, let's move into this whole transition that has really been the focus of attention over the past month or so. And I want to divide this up into three distinct phases. And we did this last week with Jeremy Lott as well. The three phases I'm thinking about here is, one, the resignation of Pope Benedict the 16th, then the election process of new pope, which culminated in the conclave of cardinals, but obviously there was stuff leading up to that. And then finally, the appointment of Francis. And again, we're 4 or 5 days into him being there on the throne of St. Peter. So let's start off with Benedict's resignation. Most popes don't resign, so what's up?
It was a big surprise. He's really, you know, acting outside the box in this sense, not just thinking, but acting outside the box. I'm not, in retrospect, I'm not so surprised. You know, he's very interesting character, Benedict. One of his writings on, one of his books on Jesus Christ, which are outstanding works, he talked about Christianity, there are norms and there are meta-norms. And the meta-norm is like the big, overriding, eternal, timeless principle. And then the norms are how those get applied in society. So, for example, the meta-norm would be human beings have dignity. They're made in the image of God. And then the norms would be all those laws and rules we get from the Bible and from this natural law that, in a certain sense, defend human dignity in the society. And what Benedict said is that, in fact, sometimes the norms kind of get out of date or no longer kind of fit right, and you need to revise them in the name of the metanorm. So some of these, maybe something that, you know, 3,000 years ago defended human dignity today might not be doing that. And he says, even in fact, the prophets came along and would challenge some of the very teachings of the laws of Moses. And Jesus Christ comes and challenges the teachings that were earlier, kind of, in a sense, challenging the norms in the name of the meta-norm. And in a sense, Benedict's doing this with his resignation. I mean, he's saying, you know, that even though the norm is the Pope stays in office till he dies, I'm going to challenge that maybe for a higher purpose, you know, presumably for the good of the church. And so when you think that way, then it doesn't look so surprising that a man like that would have done it. But you know, there's certainly a lot of speculation about why he would have resigned.
Well, some of the speculation Jeremy Lott covered last week, and we talked about some of the clues that were left that this might not be the most, I should say, put it a different way, this was more of a reluctant pope. And one of the things that I learned last week was that one of the symbols that he had on his papal seal, this bear with the backpack. Was that a little indication?
You know, I never would have crossed my mind, although putting his pallium on the tomb of Celestine, who was the last pope to resign.
Yes.
Once Benedict resigned, and we knew that story, and then we actually, I think, even twice visited Celestine's grave. So that started to make sense, that this that here was a guy that you know, he resigned because he just got fed up with what was just the curia, pretty much.
Yeah, you're talking about.
In fact, he was a holy hermit. He wasn't mm-hmm. even a cardinal. He was just some holy man that they got in a pinch to become the pope because they couldn't agree on anybody else. And he just said, you know, the heck with this after 5 months.
Yeah, I should mention that we do have a podcast on Celestine V by John Sweeney. So we'll point people back to that.
Okay.
It's a fascinating tale.
And then so one gets a sense that he may have all along kind of been thinking that if this job gets to be too much, I'm going to hand it over.
So I always had that release valve to some extent. And,
sure.
And so do you think things were starting to weigh too heavy on him, that he was maybe just fed up with the bureaucracy? Some people have mentioned, well, he's more of an intellectual pope. He really liked writing books mm-hmm. more than administrative aspects. Or was it just his health? It's just, hey, you know, sometimes it's just too hard to get up in the morning.
Well, I think health is a good bit. I think he was exhausted. You know, you say he liked to write. He did, and he wrote some of the probably the best encyclicals ever. I think Spes Salvi is the best encyclical I've ever read, and I've read a bunch of them. And Deus Caritas Est, the first half, was about as good as anything you'll find as well out there. And he wasn't even writing a lot of encyclicals, though. I mean, he only wrote three. It'd been a while since the last one. I remember thinking, like, oh, the one real benefit we'll get from Benedict's papacy is he'll crank out some really good encyclicals. And he did that for a while, and even that started to slow down. And so I'm thinking he's I mean, just on one level, physically and mentally exhausted. Secondly, I think frustrated with the Vatican bureaucracy and all the various scandals. I don't think he was disillusioned. You know, there was this view that he learned about all these scandals. He would have known about that since he first moved to Rome. That was no big secret. But I think just kind of a frustration that, you know, I can't do anything about it, or I'm too old, or I don't have the energy for that. And I think this sense, and I think what's hanging over him, and this is, I think, a fascinating issue, is his predecessor remained pope well into Parkinson's disease, was almost immobilized by disease, but stayed as pope. And I remember watching that, and you kind of had mixed feelings. And in Pope John Paul's defense, there's something really Catholic about the way he stayed in his job. Very Eucharistic. You know, Catholic Church puts a big deal on God works through matter. You know, God became flesh in Jesus Christ in the Incarnation, and we got the sacraments with God works through bread and wine and water and oils, and we've got saints' relics and holy bells and holy incense and rosary beads and on. Oh, no, it's a very physical church. And well, John Paul, by traveling, he kept up his traveling schedule while he was really, really old and sick. And that sense that I am being present for you. You know, I might not barely be able to even talk, but I'm going to be here present, you know, in this virtual world where so many people's lives never really connect with anything concrete. Right. The Pope was really witnessing to that, and also just witnessing to suffering and aging. You never see... for about 20 years, I visited a rest home every week and would read to the old people. And you see people that look like John Paul with Parkinson's in their wheelchairs, barely able to move. But you don't see that out in society. You know, death, suffering is hidden away in our society.
Yeah, they put it in retirement homes or something. Yeah.
And John Paul just put it in everybody's face. And I thought that was very, very instructive. The downside of that was he can't run the church when you're that sick. And so lots of things were not – and he wasn't a guy that liked administering anyway, nor was Benedict. So we haven't had a pope that really – I don't know when the last time we had a pope that liked to – maybe Pius XII that really liked to administer things. So a lot of stuff –
that is one of those things you get with intellectuals, and Benedict was known for his intellectual nature, is that we just hate bureaucracy.
Exactly, for sure. Yeah. And but also, you know, his resignation was still – it was very liturgically strange in the time of year it came. Because usually, you know, popes want to – you know, if you're going to start something new, transfer a priest, get a new bishop, they'll try to do it in the summer so you get to the autumn, or at least when Advent and Christmas starts, everything's or you don't want to kind of chop up Lent by having a leadership change. I mean, usually – so you'd have thought, you know, he would have done it either, you know, maybe right after Christmas – during that few weeks before Lent starts, but sort of resigning in the middle of Lent where they're really almost scrambling to get a new pope in place before Holy Week was very surprising.
That surprised me too because, well, one, we haven't had a resignation in a very long time, 600 or so years. But usually when you're running a large organization, which the Catholic Church is, 1.2 billion people, you mentioned it's at a very critical time in the calendar year, you give more than 2 or 3 weeks' notice. I mean, remember when first heard the announcement, Pope Benedict's going to resign, the first thing that went in my head says, oh, you know, he's kind of stepping down in August. Or, you know, next year, 1 year lead time so that everybody can get together and figure out what next. But it was pretty much, hey, I'm going, here's the keys, I'm going to put them in the mailbox in 2 weeks. Good luck, guys.
But there is this problem of the lame duck, you know, if you're kind of resigned but still hanging on. And then also, maybe you don't want to leave too much time for all that politicking.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, Americans, we're used to very long election seasons. But, you know, a lot of the world limits their election season to just a few weeks. Yeah. So it probably doesn't look that odd maybe to a European to have, a quicker transition.
That's true. In parliamentary systems, they decide we're going to have an election, and in about a month or two, they have the election. Yeah. So maybe he's doing that. So any other reasons why he might have just decided to step down so quick?
Well, other than the ones I mentioned, I can think there might have been some like straw that broke the camel's back. You know, this makes me wonder about that since given the timing of this, that it was just kind of, I could say liturgically a little strange. Mm-hmm. That he's, you know, it's just I mean, it's Palm Sunday coming up, and just the Pope is just finally, he technically could not even been elected by Palm Sunday if they kept the...
Right, yeah, no, that's true.
So that's highly unusual. So, and you know, maybe we'll learn that someday, maybe we'll never learn.
But, yeah. No, one of those things that's fun to speculate. One of the things you talked about with Benedict the 16th was his writings and his focus on rethinking norms in the context of these meta-norms. Do you think his action is going to set a precedent in the church? Is this going to be a rare event like it was for Celestine the V, and we're going to have to wait another 600 years? Or do you think this now, other popes, I mean, Francis the I apparently has a weak pulmonary system, lungs. He has some problems with his lungs.
I think he only has one lung.
Yeah, that can limit you.
Sure.
Do you think that there might be a precedent here, or is it too early to tell?
Well, you know, we historians hate to predict the future, but definitely I think it's kind of put an issue on the table now that you may, you know, the next pope that – it'll be easier for the next pope to resign. Right. There's even thought that John Paul was thinking of resigning, John Paul II, but kind of just stuck it out. And, you know, had John Paul resigned, then that would have made it easier for Benedict to resign, presumably. So again, the church makes its own rules about pope. You know, it's not some biblical revelation as to how you change popes or how long your term is and so on. So, you know, I don't think they'll have a mandatory retirement age or anything like that, but it definitely the possibility of resigning. But, you know, it raises a whole other set of questions. Like when you start to get, like, people pressure, you know, will pope be pressured to resign? Once that becomes a, you know, we let our Supreme Court in U.S. stay in for life, right? Because of these kind of concerns. So every, you know, you make a reform in one direction, and you're going to get new problems in the other direction. So it's really hard to say. if this will be just a one-off or if this will start to become an option for popes.
Well, something to be watching there in the future. I know historians don't like to prognosticate about the future, but it's my job to make you do that. So.
Okay.
Let's go ahead and move to the selection of the pope. And again, as you mentioned earlier here, the surprise resignation and the 2 to 3 week advance notice really didn't give very much time for politicking. I'm sure there's been cases in history where it's pretty clear that the Pope is on his way out because of failing health, and so this gives rise to all these factions, and there's other times where they just drop dead. And so let's just figure out how the Pope is picked. Is the process that we witnessed in the past month the way it's been done for a long time, or is this something new, a modern incarnation?
That's the typical, since maybe the past 1,000 years, that's how they picked popes.
Which is fairly recent.
Yeah, it evolves in different ways over time, but it wasn't anything new and surprising.
So they call this conclave of cardinals. And I guess the first thing to know is, as you mentioned earlier as well, that the bishops are key players in the church hierarchy. So who are these cardinal folks, and what is their role? Why are they important in this whole pope-picking process?
Yeah, cardinals is sort of the highest honor or title you get in the church, below pope, pretty much. And cardinals are, started in the early church. The cardinal clergy were the priests and bishops that lived close to Rome, so the outlying cities and the parishes of Rome. And the idea was, you could, if the pope needed advice on some decision, he could call them, and they could get there really quickly, and you could have a meeting. And so they were kind of his closest circle of advice. You couldn't be talking to the, bishop in Norway back then. I mean, you really had to be people close.
Long horse ride. Yeah.
And then around the 11th century, we got a pope that decided to transform this, or add to this, really, and bring in agents from around Europe. So you have a cardinal in England and France and Spain and Poland, and so that they became sort of reform. You know, it was a reform-minded pope, and they were sent out as kind of agents of reform. And so and they would have kind of the pope's papal authority vested in them as his agents. And then by about 12th, 13th century, it's all worked up into a whole system where these guys form a college that they're called together and vote for the next. But before that, popes were voted by the clergy around Rome. The German emperor had a role in the process. I mean, it was really not a fully worked out process. But in the Middle Ages, they set this all. They lay down all the rules, and so these guys become the electors. And they tend to be the archbishop of a major city. If you're a Paris or New York City, you get to be a cardinal. And then also people that are doing a lot of service for the church will honor them by making them cardinals. And sometimes it doesn't even have to be a bishop. Sometimes it'll just be a priest. John Henry Newman was a priest in England that was a great theologian, so they made him a cardinal.
So really important people who are located strategically in certain dioceses that have a lot of weight. Okay, so
and they're all out of the clergy. It's not like lay people becoming cardinals. But what also is they're going to be and then they'll get connected. They'll each have their own honorary church in Rome. So when the cardinals showed up for the conclave, the first thing they did last Sunday, they all went to their own little church and they gave a Sunday homily. And so they're connected in that way. And Rome has so many churches. And there's about 180 cardinals or so. But once you're over the age of 80, if you turn 80 before the pope dies or resigns, then you don't get to vote for the next pope. So if you're under 80 on that day, you get to vote. So I think it's about 100 and – I can't remember now. It's about 118, 113. So it's in the 110s is how many. I think 113.
So why not over 80? This sounds like age discrimination here. Just get those, old people out of there.
It is.
Those young 79-year-olds know much better.
At a certain age, because I think there's a cardinal. He's well into his 90s, the oldest cardinal.
Hmm.
And the idea was it gets a certain amount of turnover in the vote. Otherwise, if people live really long, it you don't get the college itself doesn't change. Or if you have a pope that makes a lot of cardinals, then his influence can last way beyond his own
that's
death.
A good point. That elephant gets so much more bigger. Yeah.
So they have these guys, and then so they'll come and vote. And the basic rule, I think, is they want to have about 120 voting cardinals. And you can never predict, because you name somebody a cardinal thinking somebody else is going to die or get old, but you can't always predict it. So they'd been the, if they had more than 120 that could vote, they let them vote.
Mm.
But they always end up with about 117, 118, 113. It's kind of in that range. So it's working pretty well.
Okay. So what other roles do cardinals have other than, one, they pick the pope, they convene, they have their own special churches in Rome that they probably go over, come to for a while, but do they have, are there certain responsibilities that they have that are different than an archbishop or a bishop?
They're running their own archbishopal, you know, their own diocese, but also a lot of, they'll end up in the curia. So when the Pope wants to, you know, the head of, you know, who's in charge of Catholic doctrine, he'll appoint a cardinal, or he'll make that guy a cardinal when he gets appointed. So they're handling the church's business at the tip top, and they're out in various parts of the world running these dioceses. And of course, you have the prestige of being a cardinal. So like, you know, the Archbishop of New York City is going to have a big say in American Catholic Church, even if he doesn't. If he's not the head of the bishops' conference, he's still going to have a lot of say, like Cardinal O'Connor in New York City, just because he's the bishop. And all these guys are in media centers, so they'll become the face of the church. Mm-hmm. And in the developing world, you know, when there's revolutions and coups and all sorts of things, the church will sometimes step in and kind of act as a surrogate government. And so these guys will. Cardinal Sin in the Philippines was a big figure,
yeah.
in that sense. So yeah, so they have lots of. You know, various functions. They can, you know, be as busy as they want to be sometimes locally, but.
And I know this too from watching Latin America that it is a big deal if you're a smaller country to have a cardinal appointed.
Oh, yeah.
In fact, I think recently there was a cardinal appointed in Chile. I might be mistaken on that, but it was a big deal. It was a sense of national pride that, hey, we're important here all of a sudden. So
it's top heavy in the sense there's more proportionally more Italians than yeah. numbers and more Europeans. But particularly since John Paul II, there's been an effort to get more cardinals from the Southern Hemisphere.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so we have these cardinals. Mm-hmm. And the next question is, will they come together, about 120 so, mm-hmm. give or take a few, are going to vote on Pope. Who is eligible to become Pope? It seems that the pool that they pick from are the cardinals, but is that necessarily the case? Could a professor at the University of Washington who teaches history become the Pope?
You know, I think that technically, I think it has to be a man, but I think pretty much, I think just technically, according to the, and I don't know, I'd have to go check on the, through canon law and see what are the actual rules in this. But I think technically they could just say, yeah, we can't decide who we want for Pope, so we're this professor, we're going to, and then we'll make him a deacon, a priest, a bishop, a cardinal in like 1 hour. You can do that. And bam, he's the Pope. And I think theoretically that may be possible. I'd have to double check that. But
historically, Celestine V was one of these guys.
Yeah, that's what I was going to say.
You know, hey,
yeah.
Hermit, dude, come here. We need somebody because you fit well in that chair.
Exactly. So it's been done. But so much of the, you know, there's what the rules allow and what custom and tradition dictates. And it's a lot harder to break a custom than a rule. Was that the Andy Cap or one of the comics said that? And so you know it's going to be a cardinal. It's going to be one of the bunch, and they're actually there in the conclave, feeling each other out to see which one they're going to vote for. So it would have been absolutely astounding if they went outside that circle.
Yeah, no, I know they had a number of betting sources in Vegas and in Ireland were setting odds on all these things. And you know, they were all pretty much the insiders, the curia, the most important of the cardinals who were sitting up there on the betting boards that had and such.
And it would be a church in amazing crisis if they couldn't find among, you know, 120 of their leaders somebody to take the job.
That is true. What would that say of the cardinals, all these important people you're picking? None of you are important enough to be the head.
Like Joe the plumber was elected United States president.
Yeah.
That would be,
then you know you're in trouble, I guess. So the other question when it comes to picking these folks, so the cardinals get together, they conclave, they convene, and they do so in secret. One of the more comical elements of the news coverage over the past month, or actually the past week, as we're sitting here on March 18th, is that they would say, we're going to give you wall-to-wall coverage on what's happening inside the conclave. But they're just photographing a closed door with those guards with the, you know, the colorful uniforms. And I thought that, that's kind of weird because you know, news reports, this thing is secret. They close it off. And I think there was an earlier controversy that one of the bishops was sending some Twitter messages. And they get rid of these Twitter things. And, you know, they all have to turn in their cell phones and basically isolate themselves. Why so secret?
Okay, well, you know, first of all, we do this in other, you know, I think jury trials are pretty secret.
That is true.
When my department has a meeting to discuss personnel issues, we go into executive session, and that's all basically secret. And so, my view's always been, you know, and I know transparency is important, but really important stuff almost only gets done in secret. And even when you have, like, you know, treaties being negotiated, it's not at the actual negotiation. It's in the back rooms and the bars and hotel rooms where the actual real breakthroughs are coming. That people don't – when there's cameras around, people are posturing. They're playing to the crowd. They're playing to their home constituency. They have to say certain things that they would never say in private or they'll say in private things they would never say in public. So you get a different kind of people in a public. So it makes total sense that you got this, what they would regard as the most important business that they would ever do in their life, basically, is picking a pope. But it's just, it's already a media circus. If you can imagine if they had, you know, media in there interviewing people in the course of the voting or saying, you know, how did the second vote go? Who are you going to switch your vote for the third? What a circus.
It would immensely slow down the process.
Well, it would be good for like TV ratings and stuff, I mean, that's not what they're interested in at the Vatican.
Do any outsiders try to influence this? I know that the doors close, right? At a certain point in time, the conclave starts, and I'm sure they're discussing it early on, and, you know, they're flying out in the airplane and one cardinal's sitting next to another and say, hey, you know, who are you thinking of? But are there other individuals that try to influence this? I mean, historically, I'm sure there's national governments that say, hey, we want to get our guy, or there are theologians who want to have an influence. How much of that goes on?
Today, they seem to be pretty much sealed off from this stuff, other than what you carry in with you. Yeah. But, you know, there was the last pope – I put this differently. The Emperor of Austria had the right to veto candidates for papacy.
Wow.
And the last time he did this was the early 20th century. And at that was a hangover from the Middle Ages, where the Holy Roman Emperor had a say over papal elections. And so the last pope elected was Pius X. Running against among the candidates he ran against was at least one vetoed by Franz Joseph, the Emperor of Austria. So and then the church changed the rules and says, you know, that no more emperor doesn't get to have any say at all in this process. So they're making these, you know, these are independent decisions of that group, other than what pressures they bring in their own person from wherever they're coming from.
Yeah. Well, it seemed that when I was watching the media again after Benedict's announced his resignation, that people were saying, oh, is it going to be an American pope? Are people pushing for Cardinal Dolan and so-and-so?
O'Malley,
and to what extent do you think the cardinals are immune from that, or are they influenced by that?
You know, this came. You might have even asked me this when we did the podcast on John Paul II,
right?
About were they kind of plotting to undermine communism in hindsight, you say, that was out of a great choice, and look how it turned out. But you know, at the time, remember when they first met after Paul VI, they elected another Italian, John Paul I. And that didn't work, and then you ended up getting Wojtyla as John Paul II. But there's so many interests that come in. You know, like the developing world has a different interest than North America and Western Europe. Europe and America have different interests. Latin America is kind of its own world. And, you know, and among the bishops, they're, you know, some are more liberal, some are more conservative, some want, you know, move in this direction and that direction. And when you bring all that together and then try to, like, you know, sort of work out, you know, who's going to vote for whom, and who do we think is going to be the best candidate, and can we get enough votes to get over the threshold, or at least stop, or who do we want to stop? You know, there was a sense that this one of the things that's kind of leaking out now is that Cardinal Scola from Italy, who was going to be, even though he was an Italian, he was going to be the guy that's really going to crack down on the Curia, and now argument is that enough people just didn't want him that they went for Bergoglio to sort of forestall Scola getting a majority. So again, that's all hearsay. But those kinds of things where sometimes you don't want Mr. X, and so you'll take Mr. Y even if he's not your first choice. But yeah. I think they definitely are thinking about do we want a European an Italian, a European, a developing world. Latin America is a great compromise in the sense you got this because it's kind of a European,
especially Argentina.
Argentina, and the guy's Italian, pretty much. So it was a nice kind of a transition figure. A pope just right from Africa or Philippines or somewhere would have been more of a shock, I think. Mm-hmm. But the Latin America will be kind of like I said, it's a nice bridge into this global church from Europe.
One of the things you said that some information started leaking out about, well, we don't want Cardinal Scola. It would be absolutely fascinating to be a fly in the wall during this conclave. Oh, yeah. And because there is such a high threshold, there's a 2/3 supermajority that has to be achieved in the election of a pope. So that's going to create a lot of different strategic negotiations that go on. Have there been instances in the past, and it might be a little bit early now, but have there been instances of the past where enough information leaks out that we do get a sense of the politicking that goes on, or do these cardinals just clam up afterwards? Are there any tell-all books that cardinals write?
It would be... I'm not saying there aren't, because who knows what's out there. I haven't searched it all up, but generally it's it'd be really tacky for a cardinal to start talking about what went on. And actually, they take oaths. They take oaths of various oaths during this to be secret. So that doesn't mean you're not going to you have these. First of all, you have churchmen who like to get the word out into the media for various purposes, and you have journalists that make a career out of cultivating certain churchmen. Yeah. So if you've got some, if you're a cardinal, and you've got some ally in the media, or you have maybe the priest that's your advisor working for you,
or potentially your butler, as we found out.
Yeah. So people that are close to you, they can they'll talk. And, people love talking to the media, kind of like it makes you feel important. And the media loves getting these stories. And so stuff will get out. And so there's all kinds of, stories about, why somebody got elected pope and why somebody didn't and who voted for whom and so on. One thing I want to mention, John Paul, probably the worst change of his pontificate, he changed the rules from 2/3 to, he said, if after 33 votes, you don't get 2/3. The 34th vote, you only need 51%.
Mm.
And which seemed to me like asking for people to drag out the vote and have belligerent filibustering and all sorts of things. And then Benedict changed the rule back.
Yeah, that's
so we
smart,
had for a few years, we had the John Paul rules.
Yeah, one you could think about how that sounds like, 33 ballots. I'm sure many of us are sitting here going, oh my gosh, how can you get to 33 ballots? Does everybody get thrown into the pool or what? But then, you get down to 51%, just like, finally, let's end this thing. But again, it does create an interesting counter incentive to draw things out a little bit. So here's some of the questions. From what we know, we understand that they have vows of silence and that, but some information gets out. Who gets on the first ballot? They don't put in all the cardinals, and then also, how do they eliminate people in the first round of voting? Nobody gets 2/3. Do they?
You're very interested in all of these technical details.
Well, I'm a political scientist.
I'm in the church in the world. I think the very first vote is more like a symbolic vote, where you kind of vote for people that you honor. So, like, your bishop from Brazil maybe has no chance of being pope, but you're going to vote for him because he's a good guy, and then it starts to be like, okay, who are the guys that really have traction, and who's then you're voting for like who you think's going to win, and then people get the results, and you see, okay, these are the results, and sometimes somebody that will actually ask that their votes be given to somebody else. So they'll say, I was in third place here, but I would rather see Mr. Number 2. And so sometimes those will get.
And as I understand, Bergoglio actually did that with Ratzinger.
I've read that. So those kind. But how that, because it's not an electoral system we're used to, where you just keep voting over and over and over and over again for any one of those guys. But basically, people will start to you'll get consensus around certain figures.
It's more consensus building than it's actually.
That's the whole point of this consensus building. Yeah,
yeah, I can understand how that is going to go. And what is the case of if there is a deadlock? We know from our previous discussions that we've had on earlier podcasts that sometimes they just pick placeholders. They think are, you know, this person's 95 years old. They'll last for maybe, you know, another six months. That'll give us time to get our act together. I know John the 23rd was considered to be one of these placeholders or a caretaker for a short period of time. And lo and behold, he lived a little longer.
He only lived 5 more years, but he did a lot in those 5 years. I mean, we do this in life too. You know, you can't reach an agreement, so you settle on something until the next round. And it's hard to say, even if Bergoglio, you know, he was elected pretty quickly to be a placeholder.
Okay.
So I wouldn't say he's a placeholder. I think there are definitely certain things people want out of him. But John the 23rd, definitely the placeholder, and then he shocked everybody by calling the council.
Yeah.
So that can definitely happen. You're correct.
Is there a concern, too, that the Cardinals may have that if we don't pick somebody fairly quick, it would seem that we're too factionalized, that we're a weak church? Is there some sense of that?
You know, never thought about that. Definitely there could be oh, yeah, or we're just being careful. But I think, you know, if it dragged off for a week or two, yeah, definitely the whole world would be saying there's definitely some tensions going on in there. Yeah, so that's possibly. But I don't know that they're, you know, trying to rush a vote through for public relations reasons.
Okay.
That's saying too much.
Is 3 days pretty typical? Or, again,
this is pretty typical. They usually don't drag on very long. I can't remember how many votes it took to get John Paul, but it was within a couple of days.
Okay. So that 3 days is not that big a deal. If we start seeing a month go by, we start to wonder what's going on. Maybe they're just kind of milking their hotel reservations and the good food that they're having. I don't know. Hey, what about this other thing? And this mystifies us folks who are not Catholics, is this whole thing about smoke. How did the whole thing about smoke get started?
You know, that's, again, one of those weird things that people seem to be very interested in. I think it goes back. I think it's the actual black and white smoke is really like about a late 19th, early 20th century idea. Okay. So I think in the middle, you know, in the Middle Ages, they just, you know, you vote the Pope and they came out of the conclave and they said, here's the Pope. And the city was all there and everybody knew who the Pope was. And it wasn't like you had to send some signal to the world media through the sky. It was when we start to get what happens when if you remember, when the Pope was the prisoner in the Vatican, when Italy was unified. And the Vatican didn't go along with that, or the Pope didn't go along with that, so he was kind of stuck there in his little enclave in the middle of Rome. And he refused to communicate to Rome. He had broken off relations with the Roman government, so the idea was that smoke can communicate the election of the Pope to the believers outside. And they you just waited, and then the smoke came up. And I think I've read that maybe in the earlier centuries they would send some smoke up to notify like a guy on a hillside that would shoot a cannon when there was a new Pope.
Oh, okay.
So it was more like that, kind of more like part of the spectacle. And then once we get the Vatican as the kind of the prisoner of Italy without its own relations with Italy, then the smoke starts. And I think it was about 1914 might have been the first election, around then when they started using the black and the white smoke. Oh. Which sometimes turned out gray, which confused people.
Yeah.
And they used straw and sealing wax, and then eventually it's chemicals, so it works a lot better.
The one thing I did notice, they had that smoke cam up this time around.
Yeah.
And I looked at that and I said, you know, for you know, a pretty important institution, that smokestack looked pretty rickety.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
I was like, they got
a lot of old stuff in the Catholic Church.
Yeah, old stuff there. Let me ask about the transition. You mentioned early on that, you know, back in history several hundred years ago, that Pope would be picked and then walk up to the balcony and the whole town would see it and everybody would shout out. Yeah. The one thing that surprised me a little bit was from the time that the smoke appeared, which says, okay, we elected somebody, to the time that Francis or Bergoglio, who then announced himself as Francis, appeared, was pretty short. I just want to know what happened. Now, maybe it's the case that they knew the day before, and they say, "Okay, you need to get presented. Or it might be the case of, okay, you've been elected. Here's your pallium, your robe. Go out there and meet everybody.
See, it's so funny. You thought it was so quick. I thought it was taking forever. Oh. I had just gotten a text. My seminar was ending at 11:20, and I got a text from my wife that said, oh, the white smoke went up. So I run to my computer, and I put it on, and then about an hour it took. It was just filming the crowds, and then they got the band marching through, and the Swiss guards, and just on and on. And finally, and then it's not even the Pope comes, it's the guy that announces who the Pope is. And they announce his name, and it takes still like forever to get him out there. But what's going on in the background is he's getting dressed, is the first thing. So he's got to get dressed in whatever he's choosing to wear as Pope. And then I would imagine he's probably rehearsing his victory marks. Bergoglio may not even have had a speech prepared because this was, I think, a surprise for him.
Yeah, it seemed pretty much off the cuff. And I was wondering if they were going to give him some time to warm up and say, you know, okay, you're about to address 1.2 right. billion people right. plus some. Yeah, yeah. And you're even going to be on CNN. So, yeah. You know, you want to think about this a little while longer. But they just said, hey, you're elected. You walk this way. And
it seems like a long wait for me.
Yeah, but, okay. It was
rain and all those people with all the umbrellas. And I'm sure they probably thought it wasn't quick either. But
hey, well, one of the questions I had, and I put this before our Facebook listeners, and again, just to remind folks that if you're interested in keeping up to date with the program, just go check out our Facebook page. I asked anybody if they had questions for you, and one of the questions came from John Miller, an old friend of mine, who wanted to ask, why do they always elect a real old pope? I mean, why not get one of these young upstarts?
Yeah. So this is a good question, and the age of the pope has been on my mind a lot. So the first thing, when he got elected, I knew virtually nothing about him. He wasn't one of the front runners. He wasn't on the short list of the media until that time. But I was happy enough from the little I saw of him and the little I read about him. And then when his age came and he was 76 and not 67, I thought, oh, he's going to, you know, they just had an old pope that was exhausted, and now they got another old guy that's going to be, you know, he's going to be 80 in a few years. And so I was a little surprised. In fact, I think that's why he wasn't on the short list. I mean, people were saying they're not going to elect another guy.
They're going to get one of those young spring chickens in the
upper 60s. They don't always elect old popes. They elect, you know, John Paul II was in his 50s when he got elected.
That's true.
Now, the danger with that is then he's there for too long. And there's a sense that no matter who you are, a pope shouldn't have that much of a stamp on the church. By the time John Paul, he's appointed almost every bishop in the world.
Yeah, he was around for 25 years.
Yeah. So there's the sense that you don't want somebody too long. And so there's a – but as I was reflecting on the age of Bergoglio, something dawned on me that I thought was really I haven't heard this yet in the media, but it somebody better say this soon. He's the perfect age to be like the Pope of Vatican II. If he's 5 years older, he would have been formed in the pre-Vatican II church. Mm-hmm. He'd be if he was about 5 or 6 years younger, he would have been formed in the church that was already fighting about Vatican II and in crisis. But here's a guy who, you know, it's 50th anniversary, so he's 76, so he was in his 20s. He's from 26 to 30 or so during the time of Vatican II. So he's a guy who's like, he's becoming a priest. He's learning Catholicism at a high level right when all of that's going on. So all that hope and expectations and spirit of Vatican II presumably was a big part of this guy. And so he was formed, you know, by 1965 as a priest in that spirit. And so it's, in a sense, it's the perfect age for that. And I think that's why a lot of people that really like Vatican II or like at least the spirit of Vatican II seem to be excited about this pope. He's getting a lot of positive press on the liberal Catholic blogs compared to any other pope that I can remember. Yeah. So there's this there's a lot of interesting things about this new pope.
Yeah, I hadn't thought about that. You know, thinking backwards of, you know, what were his formative years, and I didn't think about that. Yeah, it's the formative years of Vatican Council II. Very interesting, changing time within the church. And again, we've talked about that previously, and we'll point people back to our earlier podcast now. What else do we know about this guy? First of all, I have a hard time pronouncing his name. Mike, they get all these Bergoglio.
Think of like goal, like a soccer goal.
Okay, Bergoglio. Bergoglio. Okay, because they got extra G in there.
Jorge
they need
Bergoglio.
To get some John Smith or something easy to pronounce. But, you know, I still can't can't pronounce John Paul II's
Wojtyła. Yeah.
Yeah, you got that down good. I don't. So he's the first one from the Americas, and this is a big deal. And as we mentioned before, though, he's kind of a transition pope because he's from Argentina, and I've lived in Argentina for a while. It's a very European.
So that was your main country of focus on in Latin America.
Yeah, Chile and Argentina. Okay. In fact, I did get a bunch of calls from the media asking me about that, and I intentionally did not take those calls because I could see where they were leading. But anyways, Is this really a big deal that he's not from Europe? From what you're watching, is this something that the church kind of brushes away, saying, "Oh, you know, we didn't go intentionally to find somebody in the Americas. It's just he was the right guy, and so he happened to be from Argentina." Or was there a big signal?
I think it's a big deal. Certainly, it's a big deal to believers.
Okay.
And I think it was definitely something they thought about. You know, first of all, you know, when they chose Wojtyła in 78, I mean, that was not an Italian. I mean, that was a huge. They had to know they were doing something new, and I think similarly in this case, that in fact I was almost expecting in 2005 to get a Southern Hemisphere Pope, and was a little surprised that we got Joseph Ratzinger. But this is very important, because there's always the option that it's going to get back in the hands of Italians, and some people were expecting that. So no, I think it's very, very important, and it's going to raise some kind of not new issues necessarily, but long-standing issues in a new way. Certainly, things like relations between the North and South, and the global distribution of wealth, and these kinds of issues are going to become more. I'm not saying the other popes weren't pushing these things, but I think even more so, it's going to become present in the church.
And what about the fact that he's the first Jesuit too?
That's important too. Yeah.
Are they celebrating at Marquette University in Georgetown right now? They said, "Finally, you guys recognize us."
Just from what I've seen on just blogs with James Martin, for example, who's a very well loved Jesuit in New York City. Writes a lot of very interesting books, a book on humor and a book on the theater, Jesuit at the theater as an advisor to the playwrights, and on and on. He's very excited. And the Jesuit Journal America came to the defense of Bergoglio's been attacked now for his political past, and a very, very liberal guy, Thomas Rees, wrote a spirited defense of Bergoglio just yesterday in the National Catholic Reporter. It was in the National Catholic Reporter, but he was a former editor of America. So the liberals seem to, you know, there are some that are not happy with him already because, you know, they want him to start ordaining women and whatnot. But generally, the Catholic liberals, a lot of them seem to be very positive about this pope. And he seems like a kind of a figure that there's something about him that people across the board in Catholicism will like.
Yeah.
So he defends the traditional Catholic teachings, which would comfort a conservative. But he's got this heart for the poor, and he's kind of a critic of neoliberal economics and things. So the more liberal people would embrace that. It was very important that he took the name Francis.
Now, one would think that being a Jesuit, it was Francis of Xavier.
But it wasn't.
But it wasn't.
Right. It wasn't.
Well, so what's the Francis deal?
Well, this is the big question is why nobody until him has picked Francis. And I think is, you know, Francis Assisi, you know, he was called the second Christ, Alter Christus. He was like, the idea was that Jesus Christ came and taught us how to live, and people forgot that, and Francis Assisi came and showed us again. And I think there was a sense that Francis was just so exalted that to call yourself Pope Francis was really like puffing yourself up too much. It's just like you don't get Pope Jesus. You don't get Pope Peter II. There are just certain names that are off limit. But I think but this point in time, this picking it's that heart for the poor. Also, you know, Francis was a guy who shook things up while remaining, you know, loyal to the institutional church. And I think that's sort of maybe a role model for what this Pope wants to do as well. So I think it's very that's also won a lot of support for him. Just picking that name, and he picked Pius the 13th, or Benedict the 17th, or John Paul the 3rd. It would have been a very different message.
Well, that's rather interesting too. And again, this goes back to the question of how long does this guy get to prepare after it's been announced that he's the new pope? he must have been thinking, okay, in case I'm picked, what name should I have? Or or is it all of a sudden I'm picked? I don't. What name do I see? And you just, you know, the first thing on a napkin. Oh, Francis, that sounds
right.
Good.
Oh, I mean,
you know, so there must have been some thinking going on behind it. And I don't.
I wouldn't be surprised if just a lot of even just Catholic lay people always think, if I was Pope, what name would I pick?
I think I asked you that last time.
What did I say?
I can't remember. So let me ask you again.
If I was joking, I would have said Peter the Second, Pope Jesus the First, or Pope Joan the Second.
Okay,
but if I was serious, you know, I like Benedict. I think Benedict is a nice. It kind of captures the spirit of Benedict the 15th, who was the Pope during World War I, did a lot of good things, and Saint Benedict, who also did a lot of good things. So I can't remember what I would have said, but definitely it's something that crossed people's minds.
Okay, we're gonna have to re-roll the tape when I asked you that and see what you did pick to see if there's any consistency there. We talked about the Argentine thing, and again, I've received a couple calls from people asking me, well, what about this Argentine church? One of the interesting things, and I have to go back through this guy's chronology, because when I was down in Argentina in the early 1990s, I lived with some Jesuits. I stayed with them while I was doing some research. I'm wondering if he was one of the guys there. I don't know, which would be kind of interesting. It was in Buenos Aires. So I know
he might have been bishop already by then. I'm not sure.
Okay. I'm going to have to just roll back then and see what the tape says on that. But it's a really mixed bag in terms of Argentina. The Argentine church has been known for its very conservative bishops. They were very much politically aligned with the military dictatorship, so there's a lot of bad press that's related to them. But then again, on the other hand, John Paul II went in and he appointed some new people there and tried cleaning up the image of the church. And there were people who were not as conservative or politically aligned with the dictatorship as we tend to give the average bishop there in the 1970s credit for. So what's the image coming out of him? What was his role in Argentina?
Well, it's all breaking news. So you know, every day we learn something a little different. A lot of it seems to be, as far as I can tell so far, connected with just really nasty Argentinian politics. Just with you know, either people digging up old issues or even fighting about things today, but trying to use the past on one side or the other. There's definitely, you know, so far nothing like really credible's come out where you say, oh, Bergoglio was just a horrible guy in league with the dictators. And there have been some human rights advocates, including the Nobel Prize winner, Esquivel was his name, that came out in defense of Bergoglio. But, you know, the things that and it'll be interesting that, you know, I'm not an expert in Latin America by any means. This is kind of a new when I was an undergraduate, I was active in Amnesty International in the late 70s and early 80s, and we had adopted our prisoner was from Argentina. He was a Peronista, so we would write – I literally wrote letters to some of those generals in the junta down there asking that our prisoner be released and so on and so on. But so we looked a little bit into it then. But it was really a state of civil war, as far as I can tell. I mean, it was a nasty right-wing junta, and there were nasty left-wing terrorists and so on. And the church was had people in both camps and a lot of people in between. And one of the things that I think especially Americans should keep in mind, because it's not part of our national mentality, is in those Latin countries, in the Catholic Church at the time, I think there was still a memory of Spain in the 30s. You know, when the left wing took over the country and massacred 7,000 priests and nuns. And so that fear of the left that we tend to associate with, you know, Joe McCarthy, or, you know, we forgot about Spain because World War II came right after that and we got a new set of issues. But for Latin America, who, you know, technically really weren't in World War II, the Spanish Civil War still kind of has a presence. And so I think that would account for some of that, the church's real fear of the left and willingness to collaborate with the right wing. Also, you know, and for so many people, historians today, actually, this is an important line of research even for Nazi Germany and other places, is the categories of resistance and collaboration really start to get fuzzy. So in other words, something, you know, you're a resistor, but you're also collaborating. You're a collaborator, but you're also resisting. Or people trying to kind of play both sides of the equation. So, you know, you've got to, you're talking to the government and telling them things, but you're actually kind of keeping an eye on the government too, or you're doing the government a favor because they're doing you a favor on some other issue, or you cultivate certain relationships with people because it's going to benefit you in some other thing that you're trying to do, or somebody that you're trying to help, and on and on and on. And it seems, as far as I can tell, Bergoglio was, he was in his 30s, he was running the Jesuits. He was had concerned that, you know, some of his priests were getting involved in terrorist activities. He was concerned that some of his priests were, you know, could drag the whole, could create, you know, scandals. He was concerned things might happen to his clergy. It's hard to say. You know, documents are kind of leaking out here and there. And there have been, for example, one of the muckraking journalists that's attacking Bergoglio also got some of his information from Bergoglio. On how the church was hiding prisoners from a human rights group, and that Bergoglio actually is the guy that helped lead him to that evidence. So there's kind of a, you're getting a lot of like kind of mixed issues, and it really does seem like it's old politics that are still present in Argentina, and they're trying to kind of like, you know, even though Bergoglio wasn't one of the bad guys, they're figuring this is as close as we can get to sort of reopening these issues and getting some sort of, you know, being able to vent about those. My sense is, if you just kind of, I do this with people in general, is you kind of look at the pattern of their life. You think like, okay, just look at, you know, his devotion to the poor, just the his humble approach to life, just the way he's treated people over the years. And you see, basically, kind of, as far as I can tell, a positive pattern. And so, you know, when somebody says, well, he was flirting with dictators and so on, you always got to think, well, you know, if he was somebody that was involved in Vatican banking scandals and pedophilia scandals, I'd say, okay, that's probably the kind of guy he is. But when you're... When you have a pretty good track record across the board, I'm willing to be more give those people benefit of the doubt. Example, you know, I study Pius the 12th and the Holocaust. I've, you know, not won a podcast on that, and also the Catholic Church in Poland. And, you know, Catholic Church in Poland, in a lot of ways, is remembered as, you know, very heroic opponents of communism. But, you know, lots of bishops and priests were what we would call collaborating, you know, meeting with secret police and having discussions and giving information and not defending some of the priests that were. But again, it was part of a game that you're playing, and you're trying to, you know, outmaneuver the government. The government's trying to outmaneuver you, and it's really hard when you live in a free country to understand the way people have to live
in a repressed system where
bad things really can happen and so on. So it's you know, we're real quick to sort of judge people in those systems. So so far I guess I haven't seen.
Yeah, I think the other thing that we do, and especially as political scientists, is that we tend to impose the politics onto a church that has a much broader focus than just the temporal political issues of the day. That, you know, here's a guy, yeah, I'm in a very horrible dictatorship with a lot of things going on, but, you know, my duty is to shepherd the church through this time. And I think we oftentimes forget that. We're kind of at the end of our podcast here, and I know we could go on for hours because you're just a fascinating person to talk to.
And I have a lot of energy.
You do. You're like one of the best guests
I can talk all day.
Yeah,
okay.
And, so one of the questions I want to ask you is, in terms of this whole process, from the resignation of Benedict to the selection process to the new pope that we have, Pope Francis I, we talk about this in the importance of the Catholic Church a lot, and that's been a lot of our discussion here. But what about for us folks who are not Catholics? What about for us Protestants, or maybe even going outside of Christianity for Jews and Muslims? What does this all mean? And why should we care much about the selection of the pope?
Great question. So when they chose a Latin American, what was helpful or important about this is Latin America is facing two issues that the Catholic Church is facing, you know, kind of globally. And one is growing secularization, where people are just simply abandoning the faith altogether and trying to, you know, change the cultures and the laws to reflect that, like you get in Western Europe. And then the other thing is the growth of Protestant movement, evangelicals and Pentecostals and other groups that are taking people away from the Catholic Church. So you have a pope that's kind of dealing with two big problems in a place where those problems are very, very much present. And so how he deals with that, I think he, so we're getting a pope that I think realizes that Catholic Church is threatened by these secularization and also by evangelical Protestantism. He's also, at the same time, you know, the fact that he wasn't European or that he was Latin American, actually, some of the initial speculation was this guy really going to understand Jews and Muslims? Mm-hmm. Because, you know, Europe has the World War II and Holocaust, yep, and all that hanging over its head.
They're pretty close geographically.
United States has lots of Jews, and that's been a big part of our whole yep, culture. But, you know, Latin America doesn't have such a Jewish presence. It doesn't have that sort of Holocaust guilt either.
Yeah.
But we know from Bergoglio that he was a big friend of the Jews. They're praised, you know, he defended them from some, I think it was terrorist bombing
there,
in the 90s.
There was a bombing of their school there.
They've come out, the Jewish leaders in Argentina have come out praising him upon his election. So he definitely is somebody that's committed to, you know, the Catholic Church's continuing ongoing attempt to build better relations with Jews. And he'll, I think, some of the baggage about, you know, when Ratzinger was German, and that's always makes things a little difficult, and he would do a couple of things he did that were clumsy that upset Jews. And I think kind of a, you know, what would they call a restart or new beginning. And then also with Muslims, you know, Latin America doesn't have so many Muslims like Europe or the Asia or Africa or even, you know, United States. But he's a pope that has a positive record on caring about interreligious dialogue, which is very important because this Christian-Muslim relationship is really one of the key things. So I think he's an ecumenical character, although I think he's, you know, he doesn't want to see Catholicism slip away into Protestant camp. He when he first got elected, the very first day, somebody sent me to one of the very conservative Catholic blog, traditionalist blog, and they did not like this guy. And they said that he was involved in some interfaith prayer conference where he let a Protestant pastor bless him. And so he's definitely, you know, gets along with other types of Christians and other religions. So I think in that sense, he'll be continue the sort of positive work we saw with John Paul and also with Benedict.
Mm. Well, we're only 4 or 5 days into his papacy right now. So these are things that we're going to have to be watching out for. And as we run short on time here, I guess just leave this open-ended to see what's going to happen in the future. And James, we're going to have you back. And I want to thank you once again for being on Research on Religion.
Oh, my pleasure, Tony.
Thank you for listening to Research on Religion. To learn more about today's topic, participate in a discussion about what you've heard, or browse other podcasts, please visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org. And if you like what we're doing, please tell a friend. We'd appreciate the company. See you next week.